You are listening to Your Pod and Your Staff, the podcast of College Life Christian Fellowship at UC Davis. I am Peter Nittler, the college pastor of First Baptist Church in Davis, California, and our mission is to shape college-age people from all spiritual starting points into complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. And on this podcast, we want to have conversations that will form you, encourage you, maybe even make you laugh, and we hope that they would be a source of King Jesus shepherding. And this is the second episode of what we're calling Podcorn Theology. And the premise is simple. We are assuming that the Spirit can be involved and can get our attention through stories. And so we're watching movies and we're engaging with stories and we're putting those stories in dialogue with the Christian story. And sometimes that dialogue might look like a movie that shows us the truth of the scriptures in a beautiful way. Sometimes we might be challenged to live into our faith all the more fully by what we see on the screen. And sometimes by showing us a dark side of the world, we can become all the more aware of the need for redemption and restoration. And it was that last experience that marked my viewing of this movie. The movie is Parasite, and it's one of my favorite movies I've seen in the last few years. But it warrants a disclaimer. Okay, this is not a movie that you'd find in a church. In many ways, it's very, quote-unquote, un-Christian. There's bad language, there's violence, and there's a scene that, well, it deserves its R rating. So why are we talking about it? Why are we even watching it? Why are Christians dealing with it? Well, we're entering the realm of gray, not black and white, but the main reason is that we believe that good stories sometimes contain bad things. And often the people of God have considered stories as good or right only if they show the right morals, what we aspire to be. That a PG rating is a prerequisite for our engagement. But the world is different than that. The world is complicated. The world is messy. The world is broken. And when storytellers, good storytellers, dive into that brokenness and that messiness and they give us a glimpse of what it truly is, it can be a deep gift. You know, these stories can still spark conversation. These stories can show us goodness and evil unmasked. They can tell stories about reality. They can tell stories about the good life. And certainly the people of God have something to say about these things. And so I hope that we would enter the conversation. I hope that we wouldn't miss it, even if it makes us blush. With that said, you know yourself. If you reasonably don't want to fill your eyes or your ears with what is being used to tell this particular story, by all means, sit this one out. You would be wise to do it. But if you are willing to dive into the story that's being told, despite the fact that it's missing some obvious Christian ethics, I think you'll find that it's fertile ground for Christian dialogue. Enjoy the pod. All right, everybody, welcome back. This is Your Pod and Your Staff. I feel like we haven't talked to you in a while. This has been a brief hiatus for us, and we're back in front of the microphones, and it's a thrilling day. This is another episode of what we're calling Podcorn Theology. Kyle, what do you think of the name?
I'm a big fan of the name, and I don't know what kind of a person would ever degrade that name. I have no idea.
It's tops. Well, we are joined today. I'm with Miriam Hamilton.
Hello, everyone.
Good day to you, Miriam. And we're with Kyle Jung.
Hello.
Kyle Jung, you are going to be a fourth year at UC Davis. Am I right?
That is correct, Peter.
And you are the worship leader for College Life. And you and Josh Paskey, your protege, wrote and produced and executed the music that you hear at the beginning and the end and sometimes in the middle of Your Pod and Your Staff, both the first season music and for this season. Let me ask you, which one's your favorite?
That's a tough one, Peter. I think I like the second one. And that's because we really based the entire second theme off of the first theme. So without the first one, the second one wouldn't exist. But I like how the second one is more upbeat. It's got some different instrumentation. I was having a lot of fun mixing the second one around.
You know, the first one had that iconic four shakers at the end.
Oh, the four shakers were, they're iconic. This is going to go down in audio history.
It's in the audio Smithsonian. But okay, so here are some things about you just for people to get oriented with who you are. So Miriam, I don't know if you'll agree with this. I think that Kyle Jung is the league leader in people who respond this way when his name is mentioned. I just love Kyle Jung. So if you say like, oh, I was getting lunch with Kyle Jung, someone's like, oh, I just love Kyle Jung. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, me too. Mm-hmm. It's so hard not to like him. He is, he's like the Jerry Seinfeld of college life. How can you not like him? That's what he's like.
Yeah. You're making me blush, Peter.
Here's something else I'll compare you to. You are almost the one who got away, okay? Because your new sister-in-law, Nicole, used to be Aliyah, now Jung. She was a college lifer, and so her and I were scheming. Her and I were, like, really excited about you getting involved, plugged in, and then you would just sort of tease us. You would come every once in a while. We would have a great conversation, and then you would just sort of disappear. Oof. And I just kept thinking, man, why isn't Kyle coming?
Painful.
Kyle's so great. Hello, Kyle Jung. And now look at you.
Now look at me.
A college life legend without even having graduated yet. It's impressive.
It did start off in a weird way. It was being a big dummy for about 1 year, but now we're here.
Now you're here. And really, I just love talking to Kyle and always think Kyle's got interesting things to say, interesting perspectives. And so I thought, what a great conversation partner for our next podcast on another movie. And this movie, we took it to a vote. It was a democratic process, two options only. We were either going to do it on The Social Network, because it's a 10-year anniversary, and some people have called it the movie of the decade. Or we were going to do this movie, Parasite, which won the Academy Award for Best Picture. And so we took it to a vote, and in overwhelming victory, Parasite was the victor. So we are going to talk about the movie Parasite, and we are going to do the same thing that we did with Just Mercy. We're going to try and sink our teeth into the movie, the story that director Bong Joon-ho was trying to tell. You know, he put together this movie and this story, which obviously captured the attention of tons of people and garnered a lot of praise and means a lot to a lot of different people. And so we want to engage with it. This is a movie that matters. This is a movie that has been in the public conscience. And so we kind of want the people of God to think, how does this movie relate to what we believe and what truth is there in here? And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to try and just chat about the movie. And then at the end, we'll think, how can this movie be in conversation, in dialogue with our faith? And because this will be a conversation where we are trusting that people have seen the movie. And so this is a spoiler full podcast. This is not a spoiler free podcast. And this movie has some things to spoil and definitely some twists and turns. So shall we dive in?
Let's do it.
Let's dive in.
Okay. So to start, I thought I would just give us some facts about Parasite.
Great.
So this movie won the Academy Award for Best Picture, and Bong Joon-ho won for Best Director, actually won a ton of different awards. But did you know that this movie came on the scene at the Cannes Film Festival, and it won the highest award there, the Palme d'Or? And it's one of only three movies to ever win both the Palme d'Or and the Academy Award for Best Picture.
No kidding.
I had no idea.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? And this is the only movie from South Korea that has ever been nominated for an Oscar in any category.
Really?
Including Best Foreign Picture.
Never even nominated.
That's pretty crazy. Wow. I would not expect that.
And you know what else is interesting? So kind of on that, on the sort of the vein of the movie success. And so Bong Joon-ho made a movie in 2007 called The Host. And this is terrible podcast content because I'm about to just say a bunch of numbers at you. But I think it's really interesting. Okay, so you be the judge of that. But The Host opened in America in 71 theaters and made $314,000 total, okay, in its whole run in theaters.
Which is not a lot.
I couldn't tell if that was a lot.
Yeah, not a ton. But in contrast, when Parasite opened, you know, so Parasite went to Cannes, then it went to Telluride in Toronto, and it went to some other festivals. So it was gathering some momentum. And so when it finally opened in America in a super limited release, only two theaters, one theater in New York and one theater in LA, it made $376,000 in the first weekend.
For just those two theaters?
Yeah.
What?
That's insane.
Big time. Like, it was the biggest opening for those two theaters all year. Like, it was a big deal. Like, people really were excited about this movie and really loved this movie. And so the last fact is that the only thing that was shot on location, so the only thing that they shot without building a set was the flood scene, like, as they're going through the streets of Seoul. So the semi-basement that the Kim family lives in, that was all constructed, and the house that the Park family lives in was all constructed. So they, like, built these sets, which I think is really important, because I think a lot of the themes of the movie and a lot of the interesting ideas that are at play are not just in the dialogue, but also just in the physical construction of the movie. It's just everything's telling you the same story, and it's just a pleasure to watch. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. I want to hear from you guys, what did you think of the movie? What was the viewing experience like for you? Did it work for you? What were some thoughts?
I thought it was excellent. I hadn't seen it, and I actually hadn't really heard much about it. I mean, I knew Parasite was a big name movie, but didn't really know much about what it was about. And I think I probably didn't know much about it because when I hear, like, thriller, I'm like, I kind of know what this is going to be about, and just am not very interested. And then I watched it and I was like, oh, there's so much more going on here. Like, it's so obvious that there's like a message here. And I feel like, at least in my thriller experience, it's not often the case.
Yeah.
But it was just so creative and thoughtful and well acted. I really enjoyed it. It worked for me.
Yeah, it's interesting, if I may speak about your character. You have pretty high empathy gene, which I think makes you susceptible in movies to adopting the feel and the tone of the movie. Yeah. Or I would imagine you would.
I do, yeah.
And I was sort of interested how this was going to sit with you, because it's an uncomfortable watch at times.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because like none of the characters are like bad characters and none of them are like good characters.
Dude.
As in, their character is well-developed, but none of them are like, oh, yeah, you're the good guy in this, and so I am empathizing with you even. So it was really conflicting, too, to watch it and be like, I don't even really know how I feel about any of these people.
Yeah.
But still worked.
I think that's super keen insight. Kyle, what did you think?
I absolutely loved this movie. The first time I watched it was also in quarantine. I was spring quarter, like week three or something like that, because that's how we measure time nowadays. but yeah, I watched it with my parents, and my brother told me that it would be a super scary movie. And so like, don't watch it late at night or anything like that, or don't watch it alone. And so he got me hyped up for this like crazy like jump scare horror or something like that. Which it is not. It is absolutely not a horror movie. And I don't normally handle like horror that well. Like, I really thought the movie, it was like absolutely terrifying. And my roommate was like just straight up laughing at me the entire time. But this movie was amazing. I thought it was so beautiful in the way that every side was presented. Yeah, like Miriam was saying, you can see a clear vision from the director on what he sees in the world, like what are huge problems that are going on, and the way that he wants to present that to you. Everything in the movie was just so very thoughtful. I kind of put it in the same category of movie as like Jordan Peele's Get Out or Joker, you know, like thrillers, suspenseful, but very thoughtful, really. Yeah. Like driving home a point about society that's too, I wouldn't say it's too cynical. It's very realistic. It's a little cynical. It definitely leans on the side of a little cynical about just like human nature. Yeah, this movie, it's not like a feel good movie, but it really makes you think.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's certainly not a feel-good movie. I do think that the comparison with Get Out is an apt one.
Yeah.
I think it'd be an interesting double feature, actually. Both thematically, but also there's just like a mastery in both of them. Like, I feel like when you're watching Get Out, there's never a dull moment. It feels like Jordan Peele is in control of the story the whole time. You know, there's never a part that you'd think, oh, I'd change that. And I really feel that with this movie. Like, I really feel like the entire thing just feels masterful. That everything is taken seriously. Everything is measured and it fits. And I think the tonal changes that he's able to accomplish, like there are so many different tones involved in this movie that it can like change on a dime. There's like a bunch of different genres. There can be just like a hyper thriller scene. And then it changes in an instant on like on a dime to be this emotional, resonant moment. Like even just the way that the family interacts together is not usually present in a thriller. There's a closeness and like a kinship to the family that's just sweet, you know, and it's funny. Like it's a funny movie and it has no business being funny. Like what's actually happening shouldn't be funny, and somehow it is, and it doesn't feel forced. And so it just feels masterful. And I think the thing that really got me so excited, I think, about it is that I am a little bit of a nerd, I guess, when it comes to the Oscars. And I'm not even saying about movies. I just like love the Oscars. I love reading about it. We have a big Oscars party every year. And I think because of that, I really want to be the kind of person who appreciates the kind of films that the Oscars award things to. But sometimes it's like you see the Best Picture nominees and it's like, yeah, I suppose that's a technical achievement. Like, I suppose that that's a beautifully shot movie. You know, but I'm like, but it's also really boring.
Right.
Or it's also not that interesting, or it's also slow.
Wasn't there a silent film that
won? Dude, The Artist, yeah.
And
I feel this compulsion to be a contrarian to everyone who says that it's too boring, you know? Because I'm like, oh no, but you need to see it as like masterful filmmaking. But I'm like, no, it's pretty boring. And so this movie is just so watchable. It's like popcorn fare. Somehow he was able to make an incredibly entertaining, watchable, almost like blockbuster kind of movie, and also have it say real things. Like the text is delicious and rich, like the actual like movie itself, like the entertainment value. And also the subtext is deep and rich and unique and like a deep stew. Like all the flavors are complicated, but also you get them all up front too. And so that is my overall impression of what made this movie so good is I do think that sort of intense watchability and the ability to shift tones, it just feels like he's in control of the experience the whole time. And I'm with it every step of the way, you know, nothing, you know, again, there's no down moment or anything. And yet it's saying some really profound things. And there's a sense in which a lot of the metaphor and a lot of the meaning is like right in your face. So even Ki-woo, the son in the Kim family, what he says when he gets the scholar stone, and he's like, this is so metaphorical. So that's even metaphorical. Like this meta analysis of the movie itself. It's like the movie knows that it's dealing with allegory and metaphor and that that can be sort of heavy handed. And yet it still does it and it all works and it's aware of itself. It's just really, really great. And so I think we all love it. So we are going to pick our favorite scenes and we're going to have a little friendly competition. So we have all picked our favorite scene and we're going to try and convince each other and then convince our hundreds and hundreds of audience members what we think is the best scene. And if they want to let us know who won that competition, they go for it. But all right, so Kyle, do you want to be the first to pitch yours?
Yeah, the scene that I chose is actually, I think it's a combination of several scenes, but it starts when the Kim family finally has the Park family's house all to themselves, right? And then it ends when the Park family comes back home. You can break that into a lot of different parts. You can break it into like the Kims enjoying the Park's house. There's the storm. And then Moon Gwang, the housekeeper, comes back. And then there's that whole little saga of, you know, meeting Moon Gwang's husband.
That's when like the basement is revealed, right?
Yeah. And I loved that part. And then it ends with the kind of fight between the Kims and the housekeeper and her husband. But I thought that this scene was just the heart of the film. It really like drives home who each character is and the main theme, which I think one of the biggest themes was just what are your appearances and how does that relate to what is reality? And you can hide reality with appearances, but there's certain ways in which you're going to be able to see through that. So it was interesting that each family member is represented in the way that they want their life to be. So Ki-woo, you'll notice he is like looking into Dahai's diary the whole time. He notices and points out that his sister, Ki-jung, he's just like, oh, you look like you really fit in here. Like, this is where you belong. And you can kind of tell that Ki was like all about looks, all about like what's on the outside. You can tell that he kind of has a bit of jealousy for his sister, who is so good at pretending and presenting this facade. Kind of like living that good life. And the parents, they've finally gotten what they want, which is a life for their family that they think is respectable. And so you can kind of see like he's presenting this image of the Kim family, like they're finally in reality. And then you see it brings you down to the reality of Moon Gwang and her husband. It reveals the true nature of like what's really going on here. Because you'll notice like as you go into the basement, there's lots of turns. It's like compressing the space in it. You're kind of shown the reality of the Kims and the housekeeper and her husband. And I think it drives home this idea that when these people in the lower class, they have like no unity between each other. And that like when the Kim family would come down, you notice even Ki-woo covers his nose as he's going down into the basement.
Oh my gosh, I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting detail because, you know, smell is this huge, huge theme that they drive home throughout the entire movie. And so when Ki-woo walks down and he's like covering his nose, you can see that the moment that the Kim family was like raised just a step above where they were before, they start looking down on the people who are in the same exact situation. And the director really draws a lot of parallels between the Kim family and the housekeeper and her husband. The husband was talking about how he had a cake shop exactly the same way that Mr. Kim ran a cake shop. And you can see in the eyes of the actors, and that like, I thought the acting in the basement was so amazing. You can see so subtly like how quickly the dynamic changes between them. In the moment that one has power over the other, they are willing to sell each other out so that they can really live that life of luxury that they think that they deserve. Yeah. But you really see that there's so many similarities between the two families. And at the end, you see that this reality is kind of brought to light. And yeah. I thought it was really cool that at the beginning of this whole combination of scenes, Mrs. Kim is talking to Mr. Kim, talking about, you're just like a cockroach. And the moment that you shine the light on the cockroach, they all scatter and they hide in the darkness. And then you see exactly that happen. The Parks call the Kims again, and they're like, oh, hey, we're coming back home. And the movement is just so erratic, a lot like cockroaches running around.
And they're hiding under stuff.
They're hiding under
stuff. Totally.
Yeah, they're sweeping all of the debris and trash that they collected under the table, which is like, you know, where you would find a bunch of cockroaches. They're crawling around the ground. That imagery is so, so clear.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I hadn't thought about that. When you were saying that, I was also thinking about that moment when, what's the mom's name in the Kim family?
Chung-suk.
She had said, if I were this rich, I'd also be so nice too. She's not rich because she's nice. She's nice because she's rich. Talking about the mom in the Park family. But then as soon as she goes down to the basement and sees the old housekeeper and her husband, she's kind of been in this zone where she's like, I've got the power here, like feeling like she owns this house, kind of feeling like she has more wealth, and she's not very nice to them. It's just really interesting. Like, she thought that would be kind of the key to being nice. And that was just sparking in my head as you were talking about just these immediate contrasts.
Gosh, it's so good. And do you remember the exchange with the original housekeeper was calling Chung-suk sis, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then right when the power dynamic switched, right when like it's revealed that this was all a con, and now that the original housekeeper had the power to say, hey, if I tell the Parks, like, you're screwed, you know?
Right.
Now, Chung-suk was saying, sis. Yeah. There's this, like, jockeying of trying to get above each other. And it's such a major theme of this movie, and we'll get to it. I mean, like, staircases are all over the place, like rising and falling and climbing and descending. And it feels like how you navigate class and capitalism and the greed and who you have to step on to rise above, it just feels like it's so thick in this whole scene. And the fact that they sort of descend these stairs to see this family that is lower than them, when we've been introduced to the Kims as like the poor people who you would expect to get our sympathies, and look at how they respond to people who are poorer than them. It's like this system is just, you are climbing and striving to get above and climb stairs, and then you step on anyone you have to below you and make sure that they do not get above you. And I think that was such a cool twist. And I know that Bong Joon-ho, he like begged reporters not to tell people that there was this twist, like as they were reporting the movie, you know, because I think we're used to seeing just a rich poor divide. But now we have a rich, poor, and poorer sort of divide. And we're not as used to that. It sort of busts our brains a little bit. And it's a less simple story. Now it's a more nuanced story. Now, like, the quote unquote, like, protagonists are even more culpable. And also, Kyle, you were mentioning, I hadn't thought about this, but when Ki-woo was talking to his sister about, like, you belong here. And then later in the movie, he's talking to the Park daughter, who he's, you know, locking lips with. And he asks her sort of like, do I belong here? Do I belong in this setting? And it feels like he thinks no, but he thinks his sister does. And so like that whole appearance thing, do I belong? Do I not belong? Because I'm just realizing, I don't exactly know how all those things connect, but it definitely seems connected, which I think why this movie warrants such rewatches, because you just notice these little things over and over again in the script, you know?
Well, I thought it was also cool, going back to how you're talking about the separation of rich, poor, and poor. It was funny how they were willing to really split some hairs in terms of like, oh, I'm better than you because of this. Like, the housekeeper lives underground with no windows versus the semi-basement apartment is just high enough so that you can just barely see the ground. And they're kind of using that to show like the lengths to which the Kim family would go to just put themselves that much higher than the other people that they were around.
Yeah, yeah, dude. I'm feeling less good about my pick for best scene.
To be honest, me too.
That's pretty good. Miriam, what was your scene?
Well, my scene was the one just right after Kyle's, when like they all scatter like cockroaches because they realize that the family's coming home. And so my scene is like when they're escaping and then like returning home in the middle of this flood.
Oh, yeah. The flood scene.
The flood scene. Yeah. And, you know, Kyle, you had said that you thought your scene was really the heart of the movie. And I just disagree. I think that this one is. because the scene before is a lot about them living into their hopes and dreams, and you see what they really desire is like to rise above the status that they've been in, to live this life of luxury. And then in this scene, it's like, it's just in an instant, it's like the illusion is broken. Mm-hmm. And it's really, it feels pathetic. That moment when the three of them are under the table and Mr. and Mrs. Park are like sleeping on the sofa, and he's talking about the smell, and you just see it. He's like, he can't do anything. He can't defend himself. And it's just a very obvious display of like, you thought you could pretend that you have this status, but you can't even pretend. The contrast of like hiding in this house underneath this table, being mocked by even just like the smell that he carries on him.
Yeah.
It was just like so heart-wrenching and painful. And then they finally escape and they run home. And that's when you realize like the rain in this scene is much more significant than just like, oh, it's just like a little storm, because their whole semi-basement has been flooded. And it's not just like flooded, it's like flooded with sewage water. And yeah. You see like the toilet is like bursting. It's utterly filthy. And the contrast between the two houses, and even the contrast of the way that the rain affected the two families. For the Park family, it was like, okay, their camping trip got ruined. But, you know, the next day it wakes up and it's sunny and they're all fine.
Not only fine, they're like, oh yeah, what a blessing, because now the sky's clearer.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And for the Kim family, their house is ruined. Mm-hmm. And then you call back on that moment when Mr. Kim was saying to the housekeeper's husband, how can you live in a place like this, when he was mm-hmm. talking about the basement. And he had said something along the lines of like, well, lots of people live in basements. Like, right. Don't try to make me feel bad about like living in a basement. Lots of people do this. It seems like he's trying to deny like the reality that he too lives in a basement. And it's a semi-basement. So it's like, I'm a little bit above ground. I'm one leg up above you. So if I put you down, then I'll feel better about myself. Mm-hmm. But even the reality of like, because he was a semi-basement, he was subject to having his house flooded during the rains.
Yeah.
That one thing that seemed like a gift to them of like, at least we're not so bad as we're living entirely underground, wound up being like the reason that their house was flooded during this storm. And so I think that this scene is more the heart of the film in a very tragic way. And I think it's really tied together when he was back in the house and it's flooding and he's walking in, and the scholar stone that they had received from his friend at the beginning of the movie that was supposed to represent like bringing luck and wealth into the family floats up from the water, which is...
Yeah, that was weird.
Which is impossible. floats up from the water. Yeah, it's very metaphorical. And seems to be either like this irony of like, supposed to bring you wealth, but clearly it's not working. You want it so badly, but it's just a slap in the face. Mm-hmm. Or like a symbol of hope. You've had this setback now, but you can still rise above it, which I think we're going to get to at the end too, of even just like, what does the ending mean? Like, what direction are we supposed to feel of like, is this hopeful? Is it foolish? Mm-hmm. Those sorts of questions. But that's my scene. I'm sure you guys have more thoughts on it, but I think that was really tying the whole movie together.
Yeah, that scene's incredible. Kyle, do you have thoughts on the water deluge?
I also thought it was an amazing scene. I mean, the imagery in this scene is just so amazing. There was this one tiny little cut that I thought was really funny, and it was the housekeeper, Moon Gwang, throwing up into the toilet in the mm-hmm. Park's basement. And at the same exact moment, they cut to sewage water just spewing out of the Kim's toilet. And I don't know if it was supposed to be funny, but I couldn't help but laugh at that point.
I think it is. I feel like the thing about that scene that I can't take my eyes off of is how it just hammers home these different levels. You know, I feel like what's interesting is that the movie takes place basically in two places. It takes place in the house, and it takes place a little bit in the semi-basement. And yet, because of this scene, and because of like the way that they, I don't know, walk around the streets, it really feels like you have a sense that these are in radically different places. And you definitely have a sense that they're on different elevations, that mm-hmm. when they're retreating back home in the flood, they are going down stairs and ramps and hills. They are descending back to their rightful place. Mm-hmm. And I think that this idea that this flood for the rich family, for the Parks, was just a minor inconvenience, and yet for the poor family, for the Kims, it's totally sort of life-shattering. And not just for them, but when they cut to that scene where they're in the
gymnasium with all these people. It's like, this is terrible for this whole class of people, mm-hmm. you know, all these people that are on the bottom of these hills. And so the idea is like, still, yes, you got to the parks, you got to the top of this societal capitalist hill, you know, you're on top. But then what is the human casualty on the bottom? You know, and what's interesting is that the parks are not evil people. They're sometimes naive, and sometimes in their sort of foolishness, they are cruel. You know, they're not malicious in any way. Mm-hmm. And yet the fact that they're on top, like they've had to step on some people at the bottom. And so the fact that the problems run downhill, you know, it's like the problems are very, very minor at the top. And yet they just run downhill and they cascade and they multiply as it goes down. And so like the further people get down, the more these problems and these issues matter to them. And I just think it was just such a stunning display of that. That's just why I love movies. If you just say that idea to me, yeah, it's an idea. You can sort of write it off. But when you like watch it happen, it just hits home in a new way.
Yeah, I think it really is critiquing this, especially American belief of like, oh, you just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Yeah. There's a bias that people who are impoverished because they're just not working hard enough. And mm-hmm. that is an especially American idea. So I don't know how in Korean culture, how much that's kind of infiltrated the culture. But this idea, like pull yourself up by your bootstraps, like you're only in this situation because you're not working hard enough, is blown to smithereens in this scene where it's like, no, clearly they are being affected disproportionately. It's not a matter of work, character, ethic, anything like that. It's a matter of because we are poor and we don't have money for a nice home, we don't have money to live in the higher parts of society, we are disproportionately affected by something like a flood to the point where it is destroying our whole home. Whereas for you, it's destroying a camping trip that winds up being not a big deal at all. And then the next morning, the park family calls in every member of the Kim family to come to this garden party, completely oblivious to the fact that not only them, but this whole level of society has been devastated mm-hmm. by this storm. Mm-hmm. And that they're saying, well, we're doing you a favor, we're paying you extra, all this mm-hmm. stuff, so like come to our party, it should be no big deal, without yeah. thinking about the fact that they're in this gym in a shelter, don't have a place to shower, they can't mm-hmm. take care of the smell of the sewage that's been lingering on their bodies because mm-hmm. they have no home anymore. And again, they're not malicious characters, but because they're not being affected by it, they're not thinking about how it's affecting other people.
Yeah. Even if you think about the title of the movie, obviously like that cockroach line, the Kim family they are infiltrating in the way that like a parasite might, right? Or the way that at least insects or pests would. But also like, Kyle, you're a scientist. The parasitic relationship is sort of symbiotic, right? Like a parasite is something that feeds off the host agent, right?
Yeah.
They're necessary together, mm-hmm. right?
Well, but the host doesn't need the parasite.
Yeah, the host doesn't need the parasite.
Which is what a symbiotic is, right?
Yeah.
But in this movie, I think at the very least, the parks need the Kims. Like, that's they true. Cannot yeah. do their life without these people on this like super lower class doing it for them. They cannot cook for themselves. They don't drive for themselves. They don't tutor themselves. They don't tutor their own children. Mm-hmm. They need these people who are willing to work for this mm-hmm. price, you know, mm-hmm. in order to live the life that they live once they get to the top. And obviously the Kims need this money just to try to sort of climb the ladder. In this movie, it feels like the poor are vulnerable because they are able to get stepped on mm-hmm. and just crushed so easily, like an insect, right? And the rich are vulnerable because they can't do their life on their own. Mm-hmm. You know, they are not, I guess, street smart or whatever it is. They are vulnerable to be infiltrated. Mm-hmm. And because they need to bring in the poorer classes, you know, in order for their lives to run smoothly, you know?
Well, in that way, the rich are kind of also parasites on the poor, like maybe even yeah. more so than the poor were parasites on the rich. Also, I'm definitely not the person you should ask about biology. I have not taken biology since freshman year of high school.
Yeah, but your biology knowledge would be probably better than my knowledge based on a class of like 19th century British literature or something.
Yeah, I am watching Hank Green present on AP Biology on his Crash Course YouTube right now. Uh-huh. So
nice.
I so have that level.
You definitely know more than either of us. Yeah.
I don't know.
The last thing I want to say about the water scene is, did you notice the sort of homeless guy on the street who comes in and tries to pee at like the Kim's mm-hmm. window twice? And the second time they go out there to try and stop him and they douse him with water
mm-hmm. yeah.
and they like flood him essentially. Yeah. It feels like a little bit of this foreshadowing of like it all trickles downstream. Like it all trickles down the mountain of class, essentially. Like problems trickle further and further down. And so this family, the Kims, who get devastated by this water, they're also doing it to someone else. You know, they're also drowning the next person below them in water too. Again, it's like, I'm just so compelled by the lack of villain and the lack of hero in this movie. And I just think it's a very interesting thing, which is also connected to the scene that I'm picking, which I will admit is not as rich in depth and meaning as both of yours, but it is just so watchable and it's just so fun. The scene I picked was this montage where the Kim parents are finally like, it's like the final step in their infiltration. Yeah. So their son and daughter have already gotten their jobs. And now mom and dad are becoming the driver and the maid. And they enact this plan, this like really ingenious plan. And it's just all these shortcuts. And they're trying to learn how to act the right parts. And it's this really hyper detailed and everything needs to go right. It's like Ocean's 11. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like a heist movie almost, you know, it's like Mission Impossible or something. That's why I mean, it's like there's all these different genres and tones in this movie, and it's just all so delightful. And so this was just like, what a fun scene to watch, you know? Yeah. And, you know, it is interesting to think that, again, if we're going to go with this idea of there's sort of people at the bottom of the hill who are trying to get to the top of the hill, this is sort of what capitalism is. Or if we don't want to say capitalism, but just like greed and just class dynamics. And what's interesting is that we celebrate people who get to the top by probably saying that they took the right chances. They were industrious. They probably, took some risks. They saw opportunities and they seized them. And like, that's what the Kims are doing. They are seeing these opportunities for advancement, like to get paychecks so that they can feed themselves and they can, you know, have some steady income. And that impulse is celebrated in this class system. You know, that's how you say, well, that's how you, you know, rise the ranks. You know, it sort of starts with these little lies. You know, it starts with just the little lie of Kiwu saying, I went to college when he didn't go to college. And then it's like, you know, if you're good at the job, then having gone to college actually shouldn't matter. You know, you can sort of justify that as that's probably not a bad thing to do in this system.
In the broken system.
Yeah, in a broken system, like that's how you do it. And so it starts to get just a little more and more dubious. Mm-hmm. And now they're actually causing pain to the housemaid with the peaches in order to get Chung-suk into the housemaid role. And you start to see that this system creates a villainous sort of mentality. But it's not that different of an impulse of just taking the opportunity. Like, it's not that different of an impulse as to almost like want to score better on a test than someone or want to beat someone out in an interview. There's competition language built into this sort of class system. You want to be better than someone. You want to get the promotion, which is like, none of that I'm saying is bad. And I don't even necessarily think that the movie's saying it's bad, but it's just the way it is. But that impulse, especially when you combine it with hopelessness, will create a ability or a propensity to potentially bend the rules. Because it's like, well, is it that much more unfair that I'm lying about that I went to college versus someone else has a ton of money to pay for a tutor? They have that advantage. I got to get an advantage somehow. You know, we love the Kim family in this movie, even though they're dubious and even though they're dirty, even though they're crooks, really. Like, we really do love them, but we are presented with this idea like we are not invited to celebrate their situation. Just because they are the bottom class does not mean that they are morally right. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think that's what's interesting about this is that we're sort of all in on the montage scene and them infiltrating. But at the same time, like, this is not good behavior. But then again, if you look at it a different way, it's like, it's the same impulse as any way that you sort of climb the ladder. You know, yeah. I think we sort of think, okay, well, in a quote unquote meritocracy where you get somewhere based on your merit, then you should be able to do that in a way that is morally clean. You should be able to do that just based on your own merit. And so I think that this scene is showing us that, again, the same impulse is there in the Kim family. That it's like they see opportunities for gain and they work hard and they enact a good plan to make it happen. And so, yes, it's morally dubious. But the question I'm left with is, it how much more morally dubious is it than other means that people use to climb the ladder? And it gets more morally dubious as it goes on. But it's an industrious thing. Like, they're good at it. Mm-hmm. They have merit in that. You know, they have to have intelligence to do it. So, yeah, I just think it's great. What do you guys think?
I knew, like, okay, what they're doing isn't really right. Mm-hmm. But I was like so proud of them. Like, yeah. I just felt like they're so cool.
Yeah, they're doing it.
Yeah.
Well, and that kind of adds to the moral licensing, I think, in terms of, like, it comes back to, well, we're not fully lying. Like, Mr. Kim is a really good driver. It's just the means by which we get that. And you can see the way that they're kind of justifying bringing down these other people who are supposed to be, like, in the same, like, social class as them, and they're justifying it by being like, well, yeah, I mean, he is qualified to do the job.
Yeah.
And I thought that's kind of what separated it for me between that scene and like what you'd see in a normal fun heist movie is a lot of times in a heist movie, they're really punching up. They're stealing from the rich, they're giving to the poor, or, you know, you beat up just the bad guys. And you like hurt the rich, but I like how in Parasite, they're like, oh yeah, we'll still present it in this really fun imagery, but you also notice that they're kind of ruining the lives of the people who are also sympathetic characters, are also like working their best, just to kind of show kind of a realistic image of just how it really is to try and climb that ladder.
Yeah, and I think that's what's so interesting to me is like they're having to step on people too, you know, in order to do this. And I feel like it's showing us what is necessary to make this whole system work. So I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, and they talk about that when the family's, you know, all drinking on the couch together and they're celebrating that they get the house to themselves for a while. And they start talking about, oh, do you think the old driver's found a better job now? What about the old housekeeper? And Ki-jung, the sister, she's like, don't worry about them. Like, stop talking about them. We have to look out for ourselves. Like,
yeah,
this is just survival mode. We don't have the luxury of worrying about whether that was moral, whether or not they're okay. Like, that's a question you get to ask if you are already okay.
Yeah, yeah. Those are some good scenes.
Yeah, very good scenes.
Those are some good scenes. I don't think that mine is the best scene. I'll say that. I think that either one of yours wins the competition, but people can decide for themselves what is the winner. But the next thing I wanted to do for a little competition was that this movie is like way full and thick with visual metaphors and visual symbols and motifs. And so I thought we could do the same thing, that we could just pick one and try to say like why this one is so profound and so crucial to the movie and to the plot and to what it's trying to say. And we've all picked a symbol or, again, like a motif, something you see a lot, and explain how it's connected and why we think it deserves primacy in this conversation. Miriam, what do you have?
Yeah, so I chose the scholar stone or the landscape stone, which the family receives as a gift in the beginning. And it's like a very weird gift to receive. And the mom makes some crack about like, okay, thanks for the rock. I wish we had gotten some food. It's like obviously very odd. And then he was like, so metaphorical.
Yeah. Oh gosh, it's so funny.
But it's supposed to represent bringing wealth into the home. And that's clearly the goal of the family. And throughout the whole movie, it feels like it's sort of mocking them. At first, it feels like this very hopeful thing, like this stone has been brought into your home and now everything's going to change. And the whole scene of them infiltrating and getting these jobs feels like, yeah, it's working. And then you see the stone show up again in the flood scene when it like floats up in the water.
Yeah.
And then it's like just mocking them. But what's interesting is Ki-woo, he says that the rock keeps like following him, like it's finding him. And he like clings to it and he holds out this hope that something could happen. But what's so heartbreaking about that is that the stone is actually what's used by the housekeeper's husband, I don't remember his name, to attempt to kill him or to knock him out. It's his downfall in the film. And it's just so ironic of like this thing that was supposed to raise you up winds up being the weapon of your demise. So at that point, the symbol is like, okay, it's no longer something he clings to. He doesn't rely on this stone anymore to bring him wealth. And you see him at the end of the film, he puts it in some body of water, like getting rid of it, no longer placing his hope in the stone, but he still clings to and is persistent in his desire to rise above the poverty that he's been raised in and to say, I'm going to make money. I'm going to get myself out of here. And he still has that same goal and trajectory. So
yeah,
it was a really interesting symbol because it's like blatant, like in your face. The character's literally saying like, it's metaphorical. It's so like metaphoric. This is a symbol, like alert, alert.
Yeah. Not only that, but when you say a metaphor doesn't work, you tend to say they're trying to like hit me over the head with that metaphor.
Right.
You know? And he literally gets his head hit by the metaphor, you know?
Twice.
I don't know. When you're able to like call that out and it still works, it's like hard to have the critique that it's too heavy-handed
because he's like, I see that it's heavy-handed, and yet it still needs to be here, you know?
Yeah.
Kyle, what'd you think of the Scholar Stone?
It was pretty heavy-handed. He's like, oh, it keeps following me. Like, it keeps clinging to me.
Yeah.
Because it's clearly, like, his hope. But yeah, I also thought it was super interesting that, you know, at the end, he's crushed by his hope.
Yeah. You remember the scene where they're laying down and Key was talking to his dad about the plan. Like, what's the plan?
Yeah.
And dad's like, no plan. Like, mm-hmm. when you have plans, they just get disrupted. Better to not have a plan. It's like, it's this classic, like, learned hopelessness of if you keep getting beaten down. Yeah, people think you need to be industrious and have a plan to, like, rise the ranks. But it's like, why? You just get crushed, you know? So he's dealing with hopelessness. And Kiwu is clutching the stone. Like, he's holding it against his chest, like, cuddling it almost. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, he is not ready to give up. He's not. Mm-hmm. He doesn't feel hopeless. He's like, no, this dream is still alive in me. I've been told basically my whole life. I guess this is what I was thinking. I've been told my whole life that this is the point of my life. Mm-hmm. is to get wealth and to rise up. And his dad's like, just like give up on the hope. It's not going to work. It's not going to save you. It doesn't save any of us. But Key was still holding it and clutching it so strongly. It seems like that hope and that vision of the good life has so gotten its like roots in him that he can't give it up.
But I think it was interesting that like, I may be misremembering the order of events, but I'm pretty sure Kiwu puts the stone into the river right before he has that dream of becoming rich, like the original dream of like, maybe I can own that house again. And I was like, but I thought it was supposed to represent, like the stone is supposed to represent him putting down his hopes, you know?
I thought that was really interesting too. And I think you're right that it happens beforehand. It seemed to me even more hopeful because he was like, I'm not relying on this stone to bring some supernatural wealth into my life, but he was choosing instead to like pursue that entirely on his own. Mm-hmm. Like he's not just relying on like the universe or whatever's out there to bring him this wealth, but saying like, whatever it takes, I'm going to do it. And
Well, it seemed to me he was dropping the stone to just be tricked into believing another lie that he can rise above his rank and, I don't know. Maybe that's a bit of a pessimistic read on the situation. But it looks
interesting.
Because the beginning and the end are the same. And I think that like that's clearly about.
And what do you mean by that? What do you mean the beginning and the same?
Oh, yeah. So the director, like, he mirrors the exact same framing of the shots for the first scene of the movie, the title screen where it shows like Parasite and they're in the semi-basement. There's like socks hanging in a corner and it pans down from the window onto the family. And then at the end, it does the same exact thing. It starts at the window of the semi-basement and it pans down past the socks onto Kiwu, who is still hopeful. But this parallel structure, I think it really drives home that it didn't really matter any of the things that they did. They started exactly where they ended, if not worse.
Mm-hmm. It's often a really good way to think about, like, what am I supposed to be thinking about this movie? To look at the beginning and look at the ending shot. And so if they're the same, that is not something to look away from. Like, that is something crucial. But Kyle, what symbol are you vouching for?
Mine is more of a, is this a symbol or a motif? But it's one of the two. I chose the idea of smell.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and say it's a motif.
I think motif. That sounds good. Sounds smarter than symbol, too.
I didn't do that well in English, guys.
Yeah.
But I chose the smell. I think it's very close to a theme of the movie that through the whole movie, everyone's trying to put on an appearance that they are something greater than they really are. And they're really trying to fake it till they make it in the truest sense of the word. They get to higher positions by dubious means, but hope that they can keep them and add legitimacy to that. And that they'd get to a rank at which the people like the Parks would be able to see people like the Kims as people. And they do that by changing their appearances, changing the way they talk. They use a lot more English when they're talking to the Parks. And they change pretty much everything about their outer looks. But they're held down by the smell that follows them no matter where they are. And they were talking like, maybe this is another thing that we can just change by, you know, are we going to have to change our laundry detergent? Are we going to have to do different things like that? But Ki-jung, she sees through the truth And she says, no, it's not our laundry detergent. It's the semi-basement smell. It's the smell of being poor. Mm-hmm. And you can tell by the way that the Parks talk about it. It's that exact thing. And it follows them through the entire movie. It starts with the fumigation of the semi-basement. You can see that they're all so affected at the beginning of the movie by the smell of the fumigation, except for Mr. Kim, who has been broken down so many times that you can see throughout the whole movie, he can't smell himself.
Oh, man.
Other people notice it. They point it out. And he, like, reaches to his shirt to sniff. And he can't tell anymore because he's so used to it. And so I think they start that off with the fumigation.
Which you'd also do to insects.
You also do that to insects that live parasitically off of you. Super... So metaphorical, dude. Yeah, the smell is the thing that I wouldn't say it's their identity. No, it's definitely not their identity, but it's something that they can't escape that holds them down. And I think in that way, it's not a symbol for like, you can't escape who you are. It's more of a symbol. You can't escape where this system has put you. It's disproportionately hard for people with that smell to get out of that position, no matter how much they try and mask it.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of relates to even the flood scene where they get washed with sewage water. And, you know, that water makes it so that you have to come to terms with reality. That's the smell that really set Mrs. Park off about Mr. Kim's smell. It was the sewage that time.
Right. There's something about smell that just works so well for exactly what you're describing. I think you're like nailing it, you know? Something about smell that it emanates from you in a way that you, like you think about like something that's marinated in something. Like you marinate it so that it, like the flavor gets down deep into something. And the longer you marinate it for, the depth of the flavor will be all the more. You know, and it feels like in this, like the longer you're in this lower, the longer you're marinated in poverty. The more it just like, even if you change your appearance, even if you do everything that you're supposed to do to climb the stairs or whatever, then it's you're still betrayed by the fact that you've just lived in this for so long. And it is hopeless and it's sad and you just feel offended by it. And it's ultimately what makes Mr. Kim snap. It's Mr. Park smelling just the abject poverty of the man that's been living beneath his house that just puts him in like a rampage. He's like, he just breaks, you know? Yeah. I did not notice that when they went down to the basement for the first time that they covered their noses.
Yeah.
I didn't notice that either.
That was keen of you.
Well, when you watch it the second time, you start to notice this.
Yeah. My symbol was the stairs and sort of the stairs / the house. I know that Bong Joon-ho, he made a movie called Snowpiercer that was on trains. And they used the same DP, the same cinematographer. And he called the Snowpiercer one his hallway movie. And he called Parasite his staircase movie. And they're just everywhere and they're beautiful. Like the geometry of them, they're so appealing and compelling, and people are always going upstairs, always going downstairs. I mean, you can't escape it. And then especially after the flood, like they're going on these huge public staircases. And again, on one level, it's super simple. It's the rising and falling of classes, the trying to go above yourself, sometimes having to be forced to go back down. But it's like the pursuit is to get on top of the hill, to climb these staircases. And it is interesting because like Mr. Park only goes downstairs once. Every other time he's shown going upstairs. And he's definitely like the tip top. Like even he is above his wife.
Yeah.
You know, because his wife was going to give him the Ramadan first. His wife doesn't smell Mr. Kim in the same way. Like she's like maybe less offended by that. Like he's definitely like the tip top. And so he's always seen sort of going upstairs. And again, it's, on one level, it's very simple. But because of that, I think it's so compelling. And the more you watch it, the more you can see different levels and layers. But I just think that what the staircases allow is that it just really shows the different layers. Like not only is there the house and the semi-basement on radically different levels, both geographically and in society, but also there's all these stairs in the house. Like underneath, there's this hidden staircase that goes to this basement where there is just a horrific scene happening, you know? And again, I do think it's like when you climb to the top, who is on the bottom and what is their situation? Does it matter to you? Does it matter that this is the way it is? Like if there's any social elevation at all, that probably means the higher ups are going to be in a better shape than the lower downs. I don't know. It just forces us to see it in a really fun way or just like a really appealing way. And then those automatic lights that it's just this really interesting thing. It's like that's a feature in fancy houses. But then you see that it's actually not automatic lights. There's someone underneath making that happen. You know, there's someone underneath you below some other stairs that is making this possible. And you think it's automatic sensors, but really it's someone actually pushing the buttons. And again, with you being on top, who's underneath you and what is their life like?
That brings a new interpretation too of the scene when Mrs. Kama kicks the old housekeeper down the stairs.
Down, yeah.
It's a horrible, horrible moment. But also when you just add the symbolism of climbing up the stairs, trying to get to a new way of life. And then it's just like, you give it all your effort and someone just kicks you.
She was so nonchalant about it too. And she...
Totally.
She's just like, oh, nope, stay down there.
Yeah, there's that. And there's also in his dream vision of him buying the house, he's like, okay, so all you have to do is walk up the stairs and you're free. That's sort of the simplistic story of society. It's like, what you should do is try your best to walk up and progress and advance yourself. And it's as simple as that. And he has this vision of it being as simple as that. You know, he's even saying, I'm just going to make a lot of money and I'm going to be rich and I'm going to buy the house. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, that's all that we've seen so far is that that is not easy, you know, and not possible. People are consistently pulling you down. You're consistently forced to back down. So anyway, I love how simple the idea of climbing a staircase is. You know, it's so it's like a child could figure that out. But also what it's saying has so much depth. Okay, so we have talked a lot about this ending epilogue that Kiwoo goes through where he dreams this scenario of what he's going to do to rescue his father. And my question is, what do you guys think that is all about? The first time I watched it, I was very confused. Is this saying he's actually going to do it? Like, is this a hopeful moment, a hopeful ending? Or is it sort of a subversive critique? What do you think?
I think it's a subversive critique. It's definitely a little ambiguous about if it's trying to give a lot of hope and end on a happy note. Because I think we all wanted to see the Kims succeed. Mm-hmm. That would be a very movie-type ending. And I would be all about that hopeful ending if it weren't for literally that last shot of the exact same framing as the beginning where Kiwoo finishes his letter and then you see it just like for me, that really drove home that it's just he's believing yet another lie that he is really capable of getting up there and that it's really a meritocracy that gets you up to the top of the hill.
Miriam, what do you think?
You know, I think going into this, I was really rooting for the fact that it was hopeful. But Kyle, you've convinced me. I don't think it is. Just with what you just said about it, you know, it opens and closes in the same way. Like, they're back where they started, if not in a lower spot. And doesn't mean that there can't be hope that something would change for them. But he's expressing this still really naive idea that, like, he's just going to make money. Mm-hmm. He's just going to buy the house. And I think that that's also portrayed in how, as you see him writing the letter, it's being played out like as if it were reality. Like he's making money and buying the house and waiting for his dad to come up the stairs and they get reunited. And when you're watching it, it's kind of like, oh, like that was really easy. But that doesn't seem believable.
And they haven't even aged.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And then when you realize that it's just like his fantasy in his head, it's like, well, yeah, that makes sense because it kind of tricks you into realizing it's not that easy.
I think I'm actually just remembering the first song in the credits was written by Bong Joon-ho and it was sung by the actor who played Kiwoo. Oh. And I actually think that I saw this somewhere, so this might be totally wrong, but the song was initially called 576 Years and that's how long it would take for this to happen.
That's a really depressing title. But keep going.
Yeah, isn't that super bad? But I do think the first time I was watching it, I was thinking that I was watching reality. I didn't know that it was like a vision, you know? And so I was like, oh, wow, yeah, this, look at him go. He's doing it. And both times I've watched it, when it goes back to like the fact that he's writing it, I think it does. Yeah, it's like, it's too simplistic of a story. And it almost does fall in line with the narrative of just like, yeah, just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Like, time to stop playing games. Yeah. And just do it. And I do think that's a subversive critique. I think it's like, yeah, this story is a simplistic one. And the like this hope that's in everyone is not necessarily, I guess, keeping you down, but it's sort of impossible to rise the ranks, you know? So I would love to, at this point, sort of gather some of the themes that we've mentioned, Kyle, you were mentioning this idea of appearances and reality, that really the smell certainly points to that image and that theme. And, you know, I've talked a bit about, I don't exactly know what the argument is or the thesis of it is, but it's showing us class division. It's showing us what happens to a person who exists in this class division. So I don't even think that it's necessarily saying like capitalism, capital C, is wrong. I don't think that's like the thesis. You know, I think it's more complex than that. I think it's just showing what happens to people mm-hmm. in this system, you know? And then you are sort of invited to say, is this good? Is this right? Because they don't offer an alternative. They don't sort of point to a better way to organize society, but it's just saying like, this is the reality. So when you were thinking about the movie and maybe the themes of the movie, then you think, okay, well, like, we live and embody this Christian story. We want to wrap our lives around the person of Jesus and to be formed into his image and to live for his kingdom. And comes with a whole bundle of stories from the scriptures and stories that we get to live into. And was there ways that you thought our story and story that's being presented in Parasite can talk to each other, dialogue with each other, inform each other? Any sort of theological insights?
Yeah, something I noticed was how cynical the movie is about when you are struggling with situations that are out of your control. The solution that most people take is to look inwardly, to think, let's take care of me. It's a very, like, a Ki Jung answer. Don't mm-hmm. think about the people that you're bringing down. Think about how you are in trouble now. And I think it's a clear contrast with the entire message of the gospel. And I think that's pretty relevant to where we're at now as well. You know, Jesus's teaching is to love one another as you've been loved. Mm-hmm. And that when you suffer, your King Jesus is suffering alongside you. And I think that a way we could apply that to times when you're suffering, you know, when we're faced with a lack of security in life, it can be easy to just be like, oh, I need to look out for me, or like kind of take a self-help kind of view of the gospel in that way of mm-hmm. I need to take care of me, and God's going to help me in helping myself, right? And he's going to make me yeah. happy, versus I think a more realistic representation of the gospel is, you know, well, the situation's bad and it's not going to be my work that gets me saved out of this.
Yeah, no. Well, I think you're really onto something there, Kyle. And at the same time, it's not relying on God to provide in the sort of prosperity gospel way, but even pointing towards like the kingdom of God is so very different than what we're used to, where I've been thinking a lot about the Beatitudes, and it just represents this kingdom world where like to be on top is to be on the bottom. Mm-hmm. And I don't say that at all to negate the significance of like, to be impoverished, to be in low situations, we shouldn't just be okay with that. We shouldn't just be okay that the world is like, I think we have a responsibility to care and to not just be thinking about ourselves and our own selves, I guess. But also there is a reality that the kingdom of God is so different than how we've been trained to believe mm-hmm. the kingdom of the world is.
So I guess I think the thing that I continue to come back to again and again in this movie is the lack of a villain. It's not that the Parks are against the Kims. It's not that the Parks are evil, and it's not that the Kims are good. It's just showing us the people in their settings and what their settings are doing to them. And it reminded me of this idea from this theologian, Miroslav Volf, who's a Croatian theologian. And he wrote this book called Exclusion and Embrace. And one of the big ideas from that book is this idea that one of the biggest evils that the oppressors do to the oppressed is that they recreate evil in the oppressed. So it's not just that they are harming them, but it's that they are doing something to their heart that perpetuates the evil happening again. And so there's this quote that says, "From a distance, the world may appear neatly divided into guilty and perpetrators and innocent victims. But the closer we get, the more the line between the guilty and the innocent blurs, and we see an intractable maze of small and large hatreds, dishonesties, manipulations, and brutalities, each reinforcing the other." So the idea that this system or this sort of evil can not only oppress, which is not a good thing. But in its oppression, it creates evil in those that it oppresses.
That's really interesting.
And so then the world has less innocence. And then Wolf says that one of the most insidious aspects of the practice of evil is that in addition to inflicting harm, the practice of evil keeps recreating a world without innocence. Evil generates new evil as evildoers fashion victims in their own ugly image. And so that last sentence, I think, is really crucial, that evil generates new evil as evildoers fashion victims in their own ugly image. So you can see that the Kims are victims of this system, and yet they become the same kind of perpetrator to those underneath them. And so, like, evil is being reproduced in their heart in a way that is not good for anyone. And you can see how it just self-perpetuates. Mm-hmm. And the argument in Wolf's book is that what is needed to break this is self-donation, is what you're saying, Miriam. The ethic of the kingdom is to give yourself away, not to fight to be on top of someone, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just think that is so compelling. One, because I think that the scriptures see no one as innocent, you know, except for Jesus, see no one as free of blame or free of guilt. And part of that is because the systems of evil are being reproduced into each heart that gets oppressed by it. And so I guess, so one question I had, which I'm just springing on you now. So obviously at the end of this movie is this horrifically violent scene, mm-hmm. which is horrible. I mean, people are dying. People are getting very bloody, very violent. And there's a way in which you could see that scene as saying, like, all along the way, you've been competing with each other. And the logical conclusion of competition, or the most extreme, not necessarily logical, but the most extreme, is actually killing each other. All along the way, you're trying to be better than someone, but now we're shining a flashlight on this. So now it's like, not only are we just competing with each other, we are killing each other. And I guess my question to you is, do you think that what that is showing is an extreme? So it's like, I guess you can kind of make an argument that it's violence along the way, or is it a microscope to look at what is the essence of the worldview? Does that make sense, that distinction? I'm not sure I explained it clearly.
Yeah, well, I think it makes sense, but I'm seeing it as kind of both. Like, it's not true that this always ends in people killing each other.
Right.
But in a sense, that's still what you're doing, which what the quote you had shared was, it's very interesting about how, like, oppression creates evil in people and changes their hearts.
Yeah.
And is, in a sense, a sort of killing of them and changes them to be people who do the same to others.
Yeah.
And then also, quite literally, sometimes that is the result.
Yeah. Which is also, I'm way out of my element here, but, like, there's a way in which when that guy comes up from the basement to kill, mm-hmm. if you wanted to read it in terms of class dynamics, and if this movie has said, like, okay, capitalism has this, like, darkness to it. Now it's like this Marxism of the proletariat will rise up against the bourgeois violently, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like the argument is still like, well, they have the same evil in them. That's why you see when that happens, the new rulers who were used to be on the underclass tend to be as violent as the ones before, mm-hmm. you know, and tend to have the same sickness that the ones before had. And they tend to oppress people in the same way. And so it seems like the hope of the world then is for there to be a self-donation to say, I'm actually going to stop this sort of climb and I'm going to lay my life down, and that is going to be the thing that changes it. I guess I feel like if you were to say that the violence at the end is just sort of a cartoonish way of viewing this system, you know, it almost feels like the metaphor is hitting you over the head in a similar way. It's like, this is so over the top. This is so brazen, mm-hmm. that you can sort of write it off as like, oh yeah, that's sort of an extreme way of looking at this. But it's a much different argument if actually the argument is like, no, this is fundamentally what the system is built on. It's like, you say you're just trying to rise the ladder, but what you are actually doing is trying to beat other people, you know, and trying to be better than other people, which it's like, if you put a microscope onto this way of organizing the world, is there tons of different micro violences happening over and over and over again that we laud, that we claim as virtuous, you know? Mm-hmm. And this violence at the end, yeah, it looks shocking to you, but that's actually sort of the fundamental core of the idea that is shaping you. Mm-hmm. Like, that is fundamental core of your whole worldview is to beat people and to be better than people, mm-hmm. and to outlast them, you know? And the Christian story would have a much different way of organizing the world.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. But to qualify that, I think my view on that scene is, I wouldn't say it's exactly representing something like the proletariat rising up. But
I don't think it is either.
No,
but go ahead.
But, like, you look at the guy who comes up from the stairs, and he has nothing but respect for the top, nothing but respect for Mr. Park.
That's true.
He actually is killing Chunks, who took him away from the life that he thought he deserved. And I think that, yeah, absolutely, this movie... Well, first, I think it's more a movie about how things are than how things should be.
Yeah.
But I think something we can take from it is definitely that, like, the root of what started these things is not as much a heart of oppression and wanting to bring people down, but it's more of a heart of wanting to have the life that you think you deserve, you know? Hmm. And, like, that's what drove all the characters to this extreme of ridiculous killing, was failing to see other people as humans in their path toward what they saw as a noble goal of finally getting what you deserve. Mm-hmm. Yeah. More than just, like, wanting to beat people.
I think you're onto something, because, like, Mr. Kim snaps mostly when, like, he feels sort of dehumanized by the fact that they're going to, like, perform this little play for the birthday boy, mm-hmm. basically. And he feels, obviously, like, I don't want to do this. My whole world fell apart. And yes, I'm pretending to be happy for this rich family. And Mr. Park's like, yeah, but you're getting paid extra. You should be fine. It's like, the fundamental idea is that's the story we're told. Like, if you're rising and progressing and getting money, like, that's the goal of your life. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the scholar stone that you're clutching onto. And yet in that moment for Mr. Kim, it doesn't matter, you know? Mm-hmm. It doesn't trigger anything of like, oh yeah, you're right. Like, I can tough this out. Because he's like, no, I have consistently been dehumanized, and I am so dehumanized that, like, money right now does not matter.
Yeah.
Like, I want to be seen as a human being. And that's when he, like, snaps being, mm-hmm. you know?
And also, just another detail, I think right before Mr. Park lifts up the body and, like, you know, is repulsed by the smell, there's a very subtle scene in which, to get to his son, he steps over Mr. Kim's dying daughter and, like, doesn't, you know, he completely disregards her. And I think that part of that is, like, another, like, one of the huge steps that they really underplay of Mr. Kim feeling dehumanized, that his own daughter is being, like, completely stepped on top of so that Mr. Park can get to his kid.
Yeah. Well, I think we've talked about the movie. It's been really fun to do it. This movie has so much to talk about that I feel a little bit free being like, there's more meat on the bone and there's even more to talk about. It's really quite something. So shall we do some quarantine corner to give our people what they want?
Absolutely.
Let's do it.
Okay. I'm going to go first.
Okay.
Mason was given for his first birthday a Little Tykes basketball hoop. And sometimes when with an almost one-year-old, you don't always know what to do every single part of the day to make it interesting. So we opened his present early, and we have been having just a bundle of fun. And so here's my recommendation to you. Even if you don't have a child, go grab yourself one of these little basketball hoops, okay? I've been perfecting trick shots. I shoot it off the wall. I shoot it off the ceiling. I've enjoyed this much more than Mason has. So if you don't have a child, perfect. This is for you. Put that in your room. Endless entertainment, endless fun.
Fun for all ages.
So that's my recommendation. A Little Tykes basketball hoop. And just so you know, Mason has finally pointing at it, and now he wants to do some slam jams. And so I feel like he's going to be in the NBA. Mm-hmm. My future set.
He's a real baller at heart.
That's great. My quarantine corner, I say this humbly, because I give Peter a lot of flack for his opinions that, in my opinion, are just cruel and unfounded, including that he thinks hiking is no good. But this past weekend, I did the Berryessa Cold Canyon hike. Well, to say I did it is a bit generous. I have done it before, and I attempted it again this weekend. And something about, I don't know, maybe like walking up the stairs route. If you've done it, there's two ways to go out.
It's like not easy hike.
It's not an easy, thank you. It's not an easy hike. I took the stairs up, which is a longer way up, but it's shaded. But I went like at midday, and for some reason, I just like, my legs were tingling and I was like feeling nauseous like 2 miles up, and I turned around. I gave up on this hike, which is embarrassing to admit to all of our listeners.
Oh my gosh, I love it. I love that.
But I was like, I'm going to make myself sick if I keep going. But then I got home, and I was so relieved to be home. And I was like, maybe this is the key to quarantining well.
Yeah, that's
just
right.
Go out, make yourself miserable, so that when you finally get home, you won't resent it quite so much.
Which is sort of the heart of hiking, too. It's like you make yourself miserable so that you enjoy the scenery that you could have just looked up on Google. but it's not as useful. I disagree with your view. That's where we disagree.
Leave it to Peter to have a hot take. The hottest.
Kyle, what's
only.
Your quarantine corner? Yeah.
Well, my quarantine corner relates to, I don't know if the listeners at home are hearing this, but there may have been a hum in the background, and that is for a very happy reason. And that is, there is a magical box inside of my room that makes my room cooler than 100 degrees.
And low bar.
That's all I need, guys. So, to give a little bit of context, I've been up in Davis since the beginning of summer session one, so middle of June, and about 0 days in, I noticed that the air conditioning does not work in my apartment. I mean, the reason I noticed is because it does get to 100 degrees here sometimes.
Often.
It often.
It's like 75 degrees for like 4 days in the fall and like 4 days in the spring. Other than that, it's like cold or it's 100 degrees.
Yeah. So I called maintenance here and we went through a whole like week and a half long saga of just misunderstandings about what's actually wrong until they found out that they're like, oh, turns out the coolant we use has been banned for the last 20 years. So we can actually replace your unit for the next 8 weeks. So anyway.
Devastating.
The point is, my AC does not work. But as an apology, they got me magical room air conditioner. And so that is why.
Oh.
Yeah. That's why my quarantine corner for this week is having air conditioning. It's great.
It's so
again, a low bar.
I highly recommend it.
No, yeah, I'm all in. It's one of the great pleasures of the modern world.
If you want to feel like you're living like the parks in Parasite, I'd highly recommend having air conditioning.
Yeah, you don't know. Maybe there's a basement and there's someone who's like blowing cold air on you. Maybe that's really what's happening.
I think that's what it is. Wow. Someone works 24/7 to just put an ice cube in their mouth and just like blow into a little straw that feeds into my room.
I'm all in on air conditioning though. It's necessary for joy. You know what's not fun? Sleeping on top of covers and sheets. Sleeping inside them is very nice. Sleeping on top of them.
I couldn't agree more, Peter.
So it's got to be cold.
It's got to be cold.
You know, you're the only person who would have to clarify that.
Yeah.
Because for most people, that's a given. Mm-hmm. But that's also a given that people like enjoy dogs or hiking.
Yeah,
it's like Peter's thing about hiking, where sometimes you have to become miserable to realize how happy you can be with just basic things like, you know, being inside in an air-conditioned room.
That's true. I sometimes get really upset. Like, I would love for my house to be colder, but I feel like 78 degrees is what I should put it at. And so we put it at 78.
Ooh.
And often I contemplate, should we just start making the switch to, should we be a 76 degree family? Just something a little cooler.
But that's really high, isn't it? I like my house at a crisp 68, 69.
That is joy. That is glorious.
I mean,
That's like the Arctic.
I can't afford to do that, so we don't, but.
Yeah, that's true.
Very true.
Yeah.
Well, we're done. We finished. We're out of time. Thanks, Kyle. You're the best.
Thanks for having me. It's a great move.
Well, that is it for your pod and your staff. And just a quick thing to say before we go. You know, sometimes in these conversations, a certain word sort of becomes shorthand for a whole bundle of other things. And I think in this conversation, that word was capitalism. You know, obviously that word carries with it political or economic baggage. And sometimes that baggage was in sights when we used the word. But other times it served as sort of a stand-in for other things like competition or greed or meritocracy, etc. So I hope that you can listen with a gracious ear, even if the use of the word was careless at times or rubbed you the wrong way. But I want to say thank you to my friend and partner Miriam, whose time on the podcast is coming to a close soon, so you better enjoy her voice while you can. And thank you also to Kyle Jung, the Jerry Seinfeld of college life. Don't you agree? Isn't it hard not to like him? But thank you both for diving into this movie with me. I'd do it again if you let me. And of course, thanks again to Kyle and Josh Paskey for making our music. And I want to keep doing these things as long as I have a voice and you'll listen to it. So if you have any suggestions for future movies, please send them my way. And lastly, College Life, know this, that we love you more than the park's housekeeper hates peaches. We'll see you soon.